Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jacob Kanzler and Jack Spencer. A little later, we're going to be speaking with the U.S. Congressman from the 5th District. He is Dan Kildee. John Rurink was able to speak with him up on the island for the Mackinac Conference. And while he is recuperating at the Grand Ledge office, Jacob Kanzler is joining us here fresh off the island. Jacob, you ended up spending a week up there, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I went up a little early with my wife and just tried to enjoy Mackinac Island for the first time in a long time, first time as an adult. So I got to experience such wonderful haunts as like the Pink Pony.
You know, I was kidding when I told you to stand in front of the Yankee Rebel and sing Billy Idol.
I know, but it was so ridiculous that I thought it'd be hilarious to actually follow through with it and send you a video of this.
Oh, it was. It was hilarious. I've always wanted to stand in front of the Yankee Rebel and do the Rebel Yell, you know, karaoke. And then you actually did it. And then you had your wife videotape you doing it.
Oh, it was fantastic. Oh, it was great. We felt a little awkward after, but the point is we got it done, and we're able to send that to you.
And see, now you set the standard. So next time I go up there, now I'm going to have to do it.
I want that video.
Well, thank you for setting the standard on that. All right, so let's talk about some takeaways here from the island. Your general perception in covering your first Detroit Regional Chamber.
I think the best way to describe it is that it was overwhelming and underwhelming all at the same time.
Explain what you mean by that.
It's overwhelming because there's a lot going on. First off, it's a four-day conference, but really it's a two-day conference. Everything of substance is packed into Wednesday and Thursday as it was this year. Basically, all the state's elite leaders are somewhere on the island, whether it's the Grand Hotel or one of the many off-site gatherings throughout the day. And between that and like sessions involving a lot of big names, you feel like you need to be everywhere. You feel like you need to be out talking to people and trying to hunt them down for interviews and things like that, and trying to make the most of it because there's so many people there. But it's very underwhelming because even if you're trying to walk the porch and find people to interview, there are a lot of people off site. I think we had Michelle Rurink was walking up to the hotel, and she said in the middle of the day, more people were walking away from the hotel towards town than they were to the hotel. So it's one of those things where you try to make the most of it as a reporter, talk to people. But at the same time, the people who are there, the elites, the leaders, the candidates, they're not there to make news. And so you have to really try to extract what you need to extract out of them, because they're not there to make big pronouncements and announcements. And they're there to talk to each other like we're trying to talk to them.
Right. So it ends up being a little bit like a class reunion meets a business conference or something like that, a trade show or something like that, a trade show for politicians and business leaders. One of my favorite things in the edition on Friday, Jack, was on this day in Michigan history, June 1, 2001. On that day, the 21st annual Detroit Regional Chamber of Leadership event, the so-called Big Four agreed on a new blueprint on how mass transit would operate in Southeast Michigan. 2001, Jack. The Big Four agreed back then.
Well, that was really wonderful. How did that work out in the long run?
We've had how many agreements and starts and stops and so forth, and yet, you know what? If they ever agree to something, will they stop doing the Mackinac Conference? Because they'll have one less thing to talk about.
But when you stop and think about it, how many issues do we write about in cycles anyway, just covering the Capitol? I mean, there are new things that come up over a period of time, but there's an awful lot of revisits to everything.
It is kind of interesting how that works out, isn't it? Just when you get done talking about the roads, then we talk about the roads one more time. And then we get a leadership change, and then the subjects that we addressed in one direction for one party, now we're talking about them in the other direction for the other party.
Yeah, but for a lot of our listeners, that's job security, quite frankly.
One of the things that happened that doesn't happen all the time on the island, though, is a gubernatorial candidate forum. And I don't know if you call it a debate or not, but they were all but Jim Hines there, and we'll talk about Jim Hines in a minute. But Jacob, your takeaway as to the winner of the debate. In your opinion, we got some insiders giving their opinion on Friday, but what was your opinion?
Man, I'm not going to give a good answer here because in my perspective, it was tough to pick a clear winner, because really what everyone did was kind of stay very safe. With the format of the debate, the forum, and the time given, you know, there really wasn't many people that kind of rose above the other. I feel like every candidate kind of stayed in their own safe house. You know, Bill Schuette talked about his three planks he's been talking about in his endorsement of Trump. You know, Brian Kelly really rode the I am part of Snyder's transformation of Michigan, reinvention of Michigan. I'm going to talk about all the things that we've been doing. So everyone kind of stayed in their own kind of safe house, and I didn't really feel like anyone rose above, you know, a certain level. So, I mean, I would agree with some of the insiders that, you know, Bill Schuette and Gretchen Whitmer performed as they should. I would say the same as like Brian Kelly and Abdul El-Sayed, who is, you know, a good public speaker. So I would kind of leave it there.
And we tend to do this a lot, Jack, since we've watched these folks on stage for several months at least. We get to kind of know them, and we start to grade them on a curve based on expectations.
I think Colbeck actually did pretty well, but you're stopping us to think, okay, so what does that mean? It means he goes from 6% to 8%, which is good. I mean, it's like a 33% increase, but in terms of, you know, his actual impact on the race, it doesn't mean that much. You have all kinds of ways you can try to handicap something like this. In general, I thought the one who got the most out of it was Gretchen Whitmer. I think because she, as far as her primary goes, I think she stood out compared to Sri Tanadar. I think she probably created some more space between herself and him. And if you looked at it the other way, if you looked at it toward the general, her likely opponent in the general, presuming they both win their primaries, I think her compared to Schuette, I think she came out the better on that. She looked more relaxed, whereas Schuette kind of looked automatic. But then again, as far as grading on a curve, you have to kind of give some kudos to Schuette, because you have to realize the way he's been attacked by Kelly, he is holding on to a lead, and I think he is essentially, in the football term, he is handicapped because I think he's kind of playing prevent defense. Which we all know how that works. You know, you have a 21-point lead and you end up winning by, you know, 6.
Which is how Snyder won his reelect, basically. I mean, he played prevent defense on Mark Schauer the whole election cycle, and he ended up winning, even though it was super close. Probably was a lot closer than it should have been, but that was kind of the same thing that we saw there. As far as Sri Tanadar, though, we would agree. And I've watched Sri in different forms, and I've seen him do very well, and I've seen him not do so well. This had to be on the not so well standpoint. Is that because of his relative inexperience, you think, Jack, in this arena? Or what is it? Because sometimes he just doesn't connect well with a crowd like he does maybe on television.
Yeah, I think it's his lack of experience. I think he is, I hate to say it, but it's almost because he's so genuine that he then finds himself with some space to fill and then has to kind of come up with just off the top of his head sort of comments and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. It's not that they're not of some value. I would say generally, I bet a lot of people who watch this thing who don't know the candidates would come away from it liking Sri Tanadar, but whether they come away thinking of him as a governor, I think that's highly questionable.
One of the other things I wanted to bring up here was the polling, and you mentioned that Schuette's up, and we've received stuff from the pro Schuette pack that he's up 22 points. Kelly's camp indicates that it's more like a 10-point lead. Who do we believe in this kind of environment? Do we think that the lead is that big, or is that being inflated, or is the Kelly camp being a little mischievous with its numbers? Because it can't be a 12-point gap, can it?
Well, it very well could be with the amount of people that are not engaged at this point. But, you know, I know it's in our best interest as a news outlet to kind of say there's still a race, et cetera, et cetera. But it is true, if you think about it. The polling didn't mean a lot in 2016, and it ended up not meaning a lot in the governor's race in 2010. So there is some reason to say, well, maybe some of these polls aren't exactly on the number as far as some of this stuff goes. Also, the one thing about this latest Schuette one, I always wonder why only a 500-person
sample
size. I always question, why do you do something that small?
Like, it should be at least 600 is what you're saying. I mean, because we've seen primary polls at 400 before. That's not out of the realm.
Either. I'm not saying that the numbers are impossible or that means it's wrong, but I always wonder, hey, you know, you're running a race here. How come you didn't do 1,000?
Well, I think these campaigns are starting to do almost daily polls. It's a, you know, a daily tracking poll, how things are connecting. And so maybe that's more of what we're seeing. And that kind of leads me to my next point. I wanted to talk about this too. Jim Hines is going on cable, Jacob, this week. $131,000, 600 cable spots in Detroit, Grand Rapids, Flint, Lansing, South Bend, and Toledo. Is it possible that this guy could still connect?
Well, I mean, that's a significant investment. I mean, this would be the biggest, you know, Jim Hines exposure we've seen. So I think there is an opportunity here. He's been kind of rolling out, you know, little ads and kind of portraying his outsider role, which is, I think, this thing that he's really going to try to ride to exposure. And I think the Cali Schutte feud has actually been a benefit to him. He's been kind of pitting, you know, he's been kind of lobbing shots at both of them based on what they've been coming out with, whether it's the Virgin Island things with Schutte, or, you know, things that Cali is saying, or that Schutte's attacking him. And so I think Jim Hines, if he brings this message to this wider audience, this outsider, look at these guys, look at their flaws, look at what they haven't done in office. I haven't been in office. I'm not like them. Like, there could be, I'd be really interested to see how that moves him, because he's very low in the polls right now.
You know, Jack, I can't help but think that if Jim Hines was running for governor in, let's say, Vermont or Delaware or a smaller state, he might be doing pretty good. But I wonder if Michigan is too big for him. And the reason I say that is he's dealing in terms of $100,000 purchases when we have candidates who can go $1 million purchases. And that's just such a huge difference. Would you agree with that?
Yes, in a way. I would say it's not as much the state, it's who the competition is and how much money they have.
Okay.
You know, yes, obviously he'd do better if he was if he wasn't in a race with a couple people that have a lot of funding like Cali and Schutte have. And I think that's why you try to analyze, you know, him going up like you're talking about with these ads. Who does that take votes away from that he's going to get as a result of this? And I don't think that's easy to tell, because I'm not so sure the ideological way of looking at it works anymore. I think we've learned with Trump and so on that even if it's not ideological, do you pick up votes because you're seen as the outsider? Is there one thing that Hines may say that actually may make him take votes away from Cali, for instance? Mm-hmm. So that kind of gets complicated.
So if you look at it, let's say in a best case scenario, let's say Jim Hines gets 10%, which is probably overshooting it, but let's just say that he does. Does that mean that he's taken 5 points away from Schutte and 5 points away from Cali? What you're saying is that's very likely. Maybe 60% Schutte, 40% Cali. It's not out of the realm of possibility from what you're saying.
Yeah, I think that there's no way to really tell. I mean, maybe if you did some really deep study and really looked at it, you might be able to figure it out. I still think Schutte's going to win, but I do think it's going to be closer than a lot of people think.
Should we have any U.S. Senate debates on the Republican side?
Well, they can if they want to.
Is there value in it? Why don't I ask you that? Is there value in that?
Yeah, I think there'd be value to see how the two perform, because you never know. Maybe if you had a debate that it would be obvious to all the people that have to make that decision who they should be backing. That's what you don't know. You can't tell when they're just doing their own shtick.
Well, there's value in the publicity of a debate, right?
I mean,
that's what
exactly.
People – it will bring attention to a race that – if you trying to ignore the fact that, you know, Debbie Stabenow has such a cash advantage, and, you know, it almost feels like these Republicans are running in vain. And so the publicity for a debate would certainly be positive. Any kind of publicity on this race would be positive, I'm sure.
And so I wonder at what point they announce or get something together on that, because here you've got somebody who's got a lot of money in Sandy Pensler and who is probably conceivably up in the polls and would not maybe necessarily benefit in a primary race to do a debate. But in the grand scheme of the party and for the chances in a general election, it would seem like you said, Jacob, it seems like it would be of an advantage to the Republicans in general just to raise the profile of this race, because as of right now, I don't think 1 in 10 people even know what's going on.
But you know how political handlers are. You know there's going to be some out there saying, oh, no, the two of them get together. They both might say something that'll come back. You know, if they are the nominee, they both can get haunted by something they say in a debate once it gets to the general.
Yeah, but when you're down by 10 points, now is not the time to play prevent defense, Jack.
Well, yeah, but you know that somebody out there is advising that, and they're arguing with the other ones who would be advising to do it.
All right, well, with that, let's check in with John, who's right here with Dan Kilding.
We have a special guest for the MERS Monday podcast today, U.S. Representative Dan Kilding from Flint. Welcome to the podcast, sir.
Thank you. It's good to be on.
One of the things we're in the Grand Hotel right now at the Mackinac Conference, and one of the things they're focusing on is trust in government.
Right.
We're ranked 18th globally as far as the percentage of our population that feel government can solve its problems. You, a year ago here, we had a conversation. You were pondering running for governor.
Right.
You decided not to. You wanted to stay and kind of duke it out. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, why stay in an institution that so many people have questions about?
Yeah, I mean, it was a tough decision for me. I look for the best way I can possibly contribute. And I felt then, and I still do now, that I have a bit of an obligation to try to make that place better. Congress is what we make it. There's not something in the water that has spoiled American politics. It's comprised of 435 people in the House, 100 senators, and it's the attitudes of those folks that determine how Congress functions. And I actually felt that I had an additional special obligation with President Trump coming in. He's a person that I don't think respects the process to the extent that he should, and I think he's eroded trust to an extent, and I felt an obligation to try to offset that, and that's what I continue to work on.
Last year, the kind of the national approval rating of Congress, I think, slipped to the low of 10%.
Right.
I think the number, 53% of us like our guy, but only 10% of us like Congress.
Right.
It's been, I think 10 years since we did a budget in the proper method.
Right.
Your entire tenure, I don't think we've used the traditional budget process. Is that going to change? I mean, isn't it frustrating for you?
It's very frustrating because the system actually can work. It's this notion that we are polarized as a nation, I think that's exaggerated. I don't know that we're polarized. I think our politics have become polarized. But the people of the United States, they basically all want the same thing. They want opportunities for their families. They want to be able to live out their lives and not have the kind of uncertainty that comes with economic trouble. They want to be able to take a decent vacation, retire, and not have to worry. They want to, they basically all want the same thing. And our political system, for a number of reasons, has been distorted. It's almost like the politics in Congress and in the federal government generally, I describe it as a carnival mirror image of the body politic. It looks a bit like what people are saying, but certain aspects are emphasized. The extreme elements of political debate are emphasized. And what's frustrating to me is that there's actually more agreement among members of Congress than is ever manifest in the policies we advance. And honestly, that comes down to leadership. And it's leadership that it's almost like the Hatfields and McCoys down there. Mm-hmm. There are folks in Washington who can't remember why they don't like one another, but they just know they don't. And they continue to operate like the other side can't have anything in common with me because they are them and we are us. And this is where, to be honest, this is where I think the president has harmed our ability to overcome that, because that's the way he looks at everything. Black and white, winners or losers. I mean, and I don't mean to pin it all on him, because that's not fair either. But he has certainly exacerbated the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I just believe that leadership has to assert a new paradigm. And I don't know when that happens, but I know that it's only going to happen if we continue to insist on it.
We'll talk a little bit about leadership in your caucus. I mean, the question about Nancy Pelosi has been a question now for a couple, two, three cycles. Some Democrats have suggested maybe it's time for new leadership. I mean, how do you react to that? What's your feelings about
I think this in part goes back to this notion of division and sort of the caustic nature of our politics. Okay, whomever the Democratic leader is going to be the target of folks on the right, and whoever the Republican leader is going to be the target of folks on the left. And our leadership is never as good as we say they are, and they're never as bad as they say they are. You know, Nancy Pelosi is an effective political leader. It is inevitable that there will be change at the top. Whether that's imminent is yet to be determined. Mm-hmm. But the way I look at it is, you know, we elect a leader, and you don't undermine that leader until it's time for another election, and then you make the decision. We'll make another decision in November. I am among those who are anxious to see a change, not because of who these people are, or not even whether or not they're effective, but I think in order for us to turn the page on this whole issue of getting back to what we call in Washington a regular order, but what most people would think of as the schoolhouse rock version of how a bill becomes a law, for us to get back to that, it's probably going to take leadership change at the top of both parties.
Okay. Is there anything right now that Congress is effective at doing? I don't want to completely malign the institution.
You know, I think, to be fair, on occasion when a moment occurs, Congress can get itself together and take action. And I have good evidence of it because I feel a certain satisfaction in the fact that when my hometown was in deep trouble, it's, you know, still struggling, but mm-hmm. when it was at the peak of the crisis, the water crisis, I worked real hard. And I went to Leader Pelosi and I went to Speaker Ryan and said, look, we got to do something about this. And over time, it took a while, but over time, I either wore them down or inspired them. And I ended up getting every Democrat and 101 Republicans to come together for one little Midwestern town that was in trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, so when folks say Congress is dysfunctional, yeah, I sort of understand that because the big things that we should be doing are not happening. But every once in a while, there's a demonstration that this place can actually work. And the Flint issue, I think, is a good example of that.
What odds do you give Michigan of securing? The governor announced yesterday $50 million is going to be set aside to help meet funding for the lock.
Right.
What odds do you give that of happening?
I mean, I think it's increasingly more likely. I do think the greatest likelihood is that the lock funding will come with other significant investment in infrastructure, which, again, we haven't gotten to yet, but I think it's inevitable. It's possible that we can get something done before that. You know, we have, a really strong bipartisan push in our delegation from Michigan to get it done. It's a little more difficult to get something like this done that's measured in the billions when it comes to cost, when it's not folded into a much larger package. But we're not going to give up. I would say the odds are better now than they were a year ago.
How is the camaraderie or the teamwork among the Michigan delegation? Is that a partisan thing, or is it just, you know, our state's our state? And
well, there are times when it becomes partisan, but I think the difference is that when there's a partisan difference within our delegation, typically we don't make it personal. Mm-hmm. Some of my closer friends in the House are Republicans from Michigan. I work very closely, for example, with Fred Upton, John Molinar, who's my neighbor. John and I actually did the Flint Amendment together because it was felt that it needed to be bipartisan. So, you know, when we disagree, we don't make it personal. And I actually think it's easier because we know one another and we live in the same state. And frankly, we sit on the same airplane every Monday and Friday coming back and forth. But it's just, you know, it's a relatively small delegation. I wish that, you know, that the way we interact with one another was more emblematic of the way Congress functions generally, but it's not.
Do you guys have a regular meeting?
It's not as regular as I would like it to be, but we do meet on occasion several times a year. Some, you know, state delegations meet every week. Mm-hmm. I actually think we would be better off if we met more frequently. And come January, I'll have a little more to say about that, assuming that I'm reelected. Almost unbelievably, I'll be the senior Democrat in our congressional delegation. I've only been in Congress 5.5 years right now. But, you know, we've had some significant turnover.
Yeah.
I'll be encouraging the delegation to meet on a more frequent basis.
As you look across Congress at other states, is there a state you kind of look at and say, wow, they really got it figured out as far as working together as a team?
Well, there are a few. Probably the best one is Delaware because they only have one representative. So whoever it is, they really get along well. You know, actually, I think ours is pretty good in that respect. California, you know, they're so huge. It's like a state or a country unto itself. But unfortunately, I don't think there are many examples that are better than ours, and ours isn't perfect. The ones that meet more frequently tend to be more monolithic. You know, California is very much dominated by the Democrats.
Right.
So while they have their differences, I think it's a little easier for them to work together and strategize on big issues, not just on the issues that are unique to their state.
Mm-hmm. Redistricting reform, are you a backer of voters, not politicians?
Very much so. Very much so. And in fact, I think there's a movement across the country to get this right. You know, when I mentioned earlier that it seems as though the politics of the country in Congress are a carnival mirror image. One of the distortions of the body politic is due to redistricting. It is a way to sort of bend public sentiment in a particular direction. And unfortunately, the way redistricting, gerrymandering works, it bends the body politic to the extremes. Very few members of Congress are worried about a general election. All of them are worried about a primary election. And we see a whole series of primaries now, and particularly among Democrats, it seems to be sort of a left-right progressive or more moderate. That tendency on the Republican side pulls Republican members to a more sort of fundamental conservative right-wing position, and I think sometimes unnecessarily pushes Democrats to essentially pander to the base. That's fine. But I think the truth is, it's not the ideological differences that keep us from getting things done. It's the lack of commitment to try to overcome those things.
Mm-hmm.
But gerrymandering clearly exacerbates the problem.
Well, thank you for joining
My
us.
My pleasure.
And we appreciate your taking time.
Thank you very much.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Jack John, Dan Kildee, the congressman from the 5th District, and the boss, John Rurink. And since John is working out of the Grand Ledge office today, Jacob, you were supposed to bring in the fudge. Is it down there?
It is not.
Fail.
I got a point to make. Just one moment of silence here. And notice nobody's mowing anything outside. I don't even hear birds chirping outside. So this may be a very rare podcast where we don't have any sound coming in from outside the windows right now.
Wow, that was just beautiful. Enjoying the silence.
Well, hopefully it didn't scare the listeners. That's called dead air. That's usually frowned upon.
I even cut the music of Depeche Mode there.
Well, I didn't have to raise my voice to do the thing like usually. You gotta raise it an extra little couple notches because you're trying to cover up the sound of somebody whacking the bushes or cutting the lawn.
The person that I have outside trying to quiet down all the lawn mowing obviously has worked. I've got a sound cop out there.
Is that a scarecrow, or what are you going with there?
It's a secret right now. But
their check is in the mail, right?
Until next week, I'm Kyle Mullen. Take care.
Vows are spoken to be broken. Feelings are tense.